Today is Wednesday, November 15th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump has returned from his five-nation tour of Asia and touts the success of the trip.
Very proud of it from a standpoint of security and safety, military, very proud, and trade.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is in Myanmar, hoping to make progress in ending what's being called a genocide. The Attorney General of the United States gets grilled by lawmakers on Russia.
My answers have not changed. I've always told the truth.
Also ahead, a young singer that's getting loads of attention. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the U.S. Embassy in Zimbabwe's capital of Harare has closed to the public and is encouraging citizens to shelter in place, citing the ongoing political uncertainty throughout the night. The British Embassy issued a similar warning. At least three explosions and heavy gunfire were heard in Harare early Wednesday. Military vehicles were seen in the streets after the army commander threatened to step in to calm political tensions over 93-year-old President Robert Mugabe's possible successor. Mugabe has ruled since 1980. The military has been a key pillar of his power. VOA's Victor Beatty asks John Campbell, Senior Fellow of Africa Studies with the Council on Foreign Relations, whether this appears to be a coup.
I think it is a coup, but it will be a peculiar coup in that I think by the time they're finished, Mugabe will be retained as at least a figurehead. However, I think his wife and her allies will be marginalized, and some of them at least, I think, will end up in jail.
These developments that occurred beginning late Tuesday, early Wednesday in Zimbabwe happened just after the military chief, General Constantino Chiwenga, threatened to intervene to end a what he called a purge of his allies in the ruling ZANU-PF party. What's going on there?
One of the things the Zimbabwean army has always made very clear is that the government of Zimbabwe must be conducted by those that participated in the liberation struggle. Mugabe's wife was about 15 when the country became independent. So obviously she doesn't qualify. Younger people who are associated with her also obviously don't qualify. So I think what's going on, amongst other things, is that those that participated in the liberation struggle are making it quite clear that they're not prepared to relinquish power.
And last week's sacking of the vice president was perhaps the tipping point?
I wouldn't be surprised. The latest report I have seen is that the vice president is presently in South Africa. And who knows who has actually orchestrated this? It's very striking, I think, that when the head of the army held his press conference, he was accompanied by 90 senior military officers. That's a lot.
Here's what one news account says. Grace Mugabe's rise in Zimbabwe has brought her into conflict with the independence-era war veterans who enjoyed privileged status in Zimbabwe until the last 2 years when they spearheaded criticism of Mr. Mugabe's handling of the economy. Could you describe the dire straits that the Zimbabwe economy is in today?
The Zimbabwe economy has been a mess for the past decade or so. Essentially, the modern economy, which had been based on agriculture, commercial agriculture, was destroyed with the expulsion of all the whites. Subsequently, there have been periodic respites, basically caused the discovery of large-scale diamond deposits. My understanding, though, is that those have largely been exhausted, or at least those that are easy to get at have been exhausted. Consequence, unemployment is sky high. The value of the currency has plummeted. Economic activity has largely ground to a halt. And large numbers of Zimbabweans, we have no idea how many, have left the country either for South Africa or for Zambia or for wherever they can go. Now, a fairly important point. When we talk about the exodus of Zimbabweans, Zimbabwe had probably the best primary educational system in Africa. That means, and only in English, that's the only language the schools used, that means the Zimbabweans who leave the country are often very employable. so that, for example, in Johannesburg, if you call a brokerage house, the lady who answers the phone is likely to be a Zimbabwean because she'll speak very good English.
And that's John Campbell, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions Tuesday rejected accusations that he'd lied to lawmakers when he previously testified that he knew of no contacts Donald Trump's election campaign had last year with Russian operatives. Sessions told the House Judiciary Committee that he had no recollection of a 2016 meeting with a Trump campaign aide who discussed contacts with people who said they could arrange a meeting between Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin, until recent news reports showed he'd chaired the meeting.
I would like to address the false charges made about my previous testimony. My answers have not changed. I've always told the truth, and I have answered every question as I understood them to the best of my recollection, as I will continue to do today.
Well, since his last appearance before a congressional panel in mid-October, news surfaced that Papadopoulos had pleaded guilty in early October to lying to federal agents investigating Trump campaign links to Russia and is now cooperating with special counsel Robert Mueller's criminal investigation. Joining us now is former CIA officer and criminal defense attorney Jack Risa. What's your take on Tuesday's meeting?
If we looked at this in isolation, I would say not that big of a deal. Not really. But the problem is you can't look at it in isolation. What we find now is Jeff Sessions said early on, no contact at all with the Russians, no contact at all with the Russians. And then, of course, we found out that there was lots of contact with the Russians, specifically with the Russian ambassador. And now what we have is one of President Trump's close advisors, as they were talking, not just about Russia, but actually being in contact with Vladimir Putin himself. And the idea that all of a sudden he remembers that too sort of brings up this broader question about what they do know versus what they don't and when.
I thought it was interesting that he talked about the specific meeting at Trump Tower that he said he really didn't recall much about, but then he did recall pushing back on the idea of a meeting with Vladimir Putin and President Trump. So it sort of seemed to contradict.
Well, there's a huge contradiction here if you think about this. And again, I think about this as a former prosecutor and as a criminal defense attorney too, is that when you say, I don't remember anything, the problem is that you don't really have the ability to come back and say, oh, but I remember this. Because you either didn't remember it or you did remember it. And if you did remember it and you said you didn't, well, what does that say about your credibility? And if all of a sudden you were being honest about not remembering it, but then magically remembering this one piece, that strikes me as questionable at best. And as a prosecutor, my ears perked up immediately when I heard that point.
He was asked about whether or not he will be looking to potentially appoint another special counsel to investigate Hillary Clinton, not ruling it out. What do you make of that?
I think it's petrifying. It's petrifying because this isn't what the United States is. This is not a left or right question. It truly isn't. But it's petrifying because this is what, in some parts of the world, the new leader does to the old leader, or one person does to the previous administration as a way of cutting them down to increase your own credibility and increase your own power. But what it really does is it undercuts the underpinnings of the stability of a government that sort of rises above the left or the right. And that's exactly what this does.
Right. And it's interesting, too, because the president just about 12 days ago or so said he was really disappointed that he couldn't be involved in the FBI and the Justice Department, that it was a separate entity from the presidency. And he was disappointed because he felt like he didn't understand why they weren't going after his former rival, Hillary Clinton. But as you just said, that would be would that be an abuse of power?
Yes. Yes, it would. And here's the problem. And then this is an example of this president fundamentally not understanding how the U.S. government works and, frankly, how the Justice Department works. The Justice Department and the FBI is not essentially a personal bodyguard, a personal investigatory service, and essentially a bunch of jackboots for your liking and for your whims. I mean, that's not what they are. That's not what they're designed to be. They're supposed to rise above the left and the right and do what it is that they do. they don't do what the president wants because the president wants it.
Mm-hmm.
They uphold the law. That's their job. Their job is to prosecute those who violate crimes and to investigate those issues. But it's not based upon the whim of the president that says, go after the people I hate. That is very Nixonian. And that's something that fundamentally we have to fight against, all of us, left and right.
And the WikiLeaks situation, you know, WikiLeaks was responsible for all of the stolen emails of Hillary Clinton's during the campaign. And we just had new revelations this past week that Donald Trump Jr. had apparently had some correspondence with them.
Yeah, that's astounding as well when you consider that Vice President Pence came out very publicly and said this administration and all of its supporters had no contact of any kind with WikiLeaks. But it actually makes it worse than that, because in this particular case, this is the possibility of WikiLeaks being in contact with Russian operatives to get access to that information and then disclosing it. If that is actually a part of a broader triumvirate between the Russians, WikiLeaks, and the Trump administration, which is what actually is being investigated right now, this ties them one step closer to that issue.
All right, former CIA officer Jack Rice, thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. At least four people have been killed in a shooting near a California elementary school. A new study finds internet freedom is worsening in Pakistan. President Trump's nuclear authority is being reviewed on Capitol Hill. And with most of Puerto Rico still in the dark, many residents are leaving. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Trump has just arrived back at the White House after his five-nation, 12-day trip to Asia. As he was departing for his trip back to the U.S., though, he touted it was a big success.
Very proud of it from a standpoint of security and safety, military, very proud, and trade. You will see numbers that you won't believe over the years.
Speaking to reporters aboard Air Force One as he began the journey home, he also felt progress was made on the North Korean nuclear threat.
It's also been really good in terms of North Korea and getting everybody together. I think their acts are all together. China has been excellent. Japan and South Korea have been excellent. I think that's a very important part of the trip.
The president also says he has plans to make a major announcement, and he gave no indication what that might be. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is expected to address the issue of hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims who fled violence in Myanmar as he visits that nation, also known as Burma, on Wednesday. Calls have been mounting for the Trump administration to adopt a stronger stance on the crisis. VOA's Mil Arcega has more on this crisis that has triggered the largest refugee exodus in Asia in decades.
The report contradicts consistent statements from ethnic Rohingya Muslim refugees now in Bangladesh. Some arrived with gunshot wounds and severe burns. Others have described massacres, rape, looting, and the burning of hundreds of villages by Myanmar's army and civilian mobs. The UN Humanitarian Office said Tuesday that the number of Rohingya who have fled Myanmar to Bangladesh since August 25th has risen to 618,000. While the report acknowledged that battles against militants from the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army had left 376 terrorists dead, it also claimed security forces had never shot at the innocent Bengalis and that there was no death of innocent people. Myanmar's government and most of the Buddhist majority say the members of the Muslim minority are Bengalis who migrated illegally from Bangladesh and do not acknowledge the Rohingya as a local ethnic group, even though they have lived in Myanmar. Mil Arcega, VOA News.
Well, time now to check in with VOA's Andrew Palchewski for a check on what is trending on social media. Hey, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, Lori, Facebook is the largest social network in the world, and it tries to do a lot of good, but sometimes they can come up a bit short. Of course, when you have 2 billion monthly active users, it happens from time to time. So today, 2 stories where Facebook came up a little bit short. And the first started a year ago in December 2016. You might remember that Facebook announced that it was going to partner with a bunch of major news outlets like the Associated Press, FactCheck.org, ABC News here in the United States, to create a fact-checking system to weed out fake news and mark stories as fake or disputed. Well, a year later, it's not going that well, because according to people charged with doing that fact-checking, a number of the third-party companies hired to do the work aren't actually doing it. They say that Facebook's efforts are little more than a publicity stunt. Misinformation has only continued to spread. Fake articles that are supposed to be tagged aren't being tagged. And Facebook's not releasing the data on this. So Facebook has responded saying that their work with the third-party fact-checkers is not just meant to educate people, but it's helping to better understand what might be false and show it less on the news feed. So not exactly addressing those concerns. We'll see if they come out with anything further to try to increase the fact-checking and increase the marking of fake news stories as disputed. But right now, apparently, they're not doing that.
Well, they'll probably continue to be under a lot of scrutiny until something changes, I would imagine.
For sure. I mean, one thing that we've seen is Facebook has been held accountable when they don't do these things. So if they're not getting rid of fake news, or as in our next story, they're actively contributing to a problem, they tend to address it.
Okay, that leads me to what is your next story, Andrew?
Well, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has been touring the country, and he said that as he's gone around to meet with people, one of the things he's been struck by is the extent of the opioid epidemic in the United States. Of course, opioid drugs, heroin, prescription drugs, fentanyl is one of the ones that a lot of people have been using. These are taking lives more so than gun violence or car accidents combined in the United States. So this is really an epidemic. But Facebook actually might be contributing to that problem, because there is a secret kind of network on Facebook where you can purchase opioid drugs. You have to use specific terms to search for them, but journalists have found this, that if you search for certain names of drugs and certain words, that these ads will come up that people have posted where you can purchase these drugs from them.
That's frightening.
It is. And it's something, obviously, that Facebook does not want its users to be doing. They've come out with a statement where they say anyone can report content. People can flag pages, profiles, ads for review. In this case, these were flagged and they were reviewed by their community operations team. They said they remove violating content as soon as they become aware of it. And that's what they did with these pages. Now, not clear the extent that this has actually happened, because people are reporting that these ads and pages are still accessible. But again, now that it's been raised to Facebook's attention, and more importantly, raised in public attention through journalism, I have a feeling that it's going to be addressed, and pretty quickly.
All right, Andrew, thank you as always. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues now with news out of Hollywood. And for that, we're joined by Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. Hi, Nicole. So actor Kevin Spacey, boy, he's been in the news lately for all the wrong reasons. And apparently the problems are more numerous than we heard.
Yeah, so back in 2004, he took on the job as the artistic director at the Old Vic Theatre in London, England. And during that time, I guess, he got a private tour of Buckingham Palace by Prince Andrew. And when he was in the throne room, he, according to a source who previously might have worked at the palace, he sat on the Queen's throne. And this is her throne from her coronation, so it's a big no-no to sit on the Queen's throne. And apparently he took some pictures while he was on it. The source that told the Sunday Times that this happened said that the Queen would not have been pleased if she had seen that. But we know this isn't the only reason why Kevin Spacey's in the news. He has been accused by at least 15 men of sexual misconduct through the years. He was first accused by actor Anthony Rapp, who claimed that he made a sexual advance on him when he was 14 years old. And Kevin Spacey acknowledged that and actually came out as a gay man on Twitter at the same time. I believe that he denied the allegations, but said that he is a gay man, which is the first time that he has come out. And since then, I think that he has checked into the same rehab facility that shamed producer Harvey Weinstein is also receiving treatment at.
Wow. This is just crazy stuff happening. And I guess you do have another story that's a little more heartwarming than that one with regard to Michael Bublé. And I know he's had a really rough go of it lately.
Yeah, I was really happy when I saw this story because he has taken kind of a backseat from his career over the last year after his four-year-old son was diagnosed with cancer. He made that announcement back in November of last year and said that he would be taking a break to focus on his family while his son was receiving treatment in the United States. But in February, he shared that his son was doing much, much better, and he was going to be hopefully just fine. But he's now planning a return to the stage. Michael Bublé is coming back in July 2018. He is set to perform at the British Summertime in Hyde Park. And he also has been out before in public since his son's diagnosis. He was seen in June accepting a National Arts Center Award in Canada, and he talked about the love of his family and all of the support of his fans. So it's really nice to hear that he and his family are doing much better, and he'll be back to the stage soon. I hope he comes out with another Christmas album.
All right. Thanks so much. As always, that's Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. A young singer has released a new single that's getting a whole lot of attention. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with all the details.
A balladeer whose name is Charlie Puth. And Charlie became famous several years ago for a mega hit, which he recorded for the film Furious 7 as a tribute to the late actor Paul Walker, called See You Again. It was a collaboration between Charlie and Wiz Khalifa. And after that, he followed with his debut solo album, Nine Track Mind, which gave us a couple of big hits, One Call Away, and also Marvin Gaye with Meghan Trainor, and of course the huge hit, We Don't Talk Anymore with Selena Gomez. And that also sparked a bit of controversy with Charlie and Selena Gomez, because Charlie had a thing for Selena, and Selena didn't have a thing for Charlie.
Oh.
And that story continues to this day, and I'll elaborate a little bit more as we go. But today's brand new song from Charlie Puth is the second single off of his upcoming sophomore album. The album's called Voice Notes. It goes on sale in 2018, and today's song is called How Long.
I'll admit I was wrong. What else can I say, girl? Can't you play my head and not my heart? I was drunk, I was gone. That don't make it right, but promise there were no feelings involved.
So what were you going to say about Charlie Puth then?
Well, I'm glad you asked about Charlie Puth and his past love of Selena Gomez. He worked with her to collaborate on the hit song We Don't Talk Anymore. He admitted he had feelings for her. She never really responded publicly. She got a dog this past year. She named the dog Charlie, although she's been dating The Weeknd until recently, when The Weeknd and Selena broke up, and Selena's now back together with Justin Bieber.
Wow.
Yes, they're back together again.
As the world turns.
As the world turns. What goes around comes around. And Charlie Puth, his name has come up again with regard to Selena Gomez, even though that's been over for a while, because apparently he and Justin Bieber had a tit for tat on social media because Charlie likes Selena. And as we all know, Justin likes Selena and loves Selena. And so it wasn't cool with Justin, so they got into a little war of words on the internet. They've patched things up. In fact, Charlie recently admitted, yes, there has been a handshake. And there's even a possible collaboration down the road between Charlie and Justin. Meanwhile, Charlie has been the opening act for Shawn Mendes on tour. Even Charlie doesn't realize how popular he is. He said, I'm amazed that people come out to see me. He gets on stage. He sings his song. He's a nerd by nature. He grew up a computer guy. He recorded his whole first album in his parents' bedroom on his laptop computer. And that's just kind of the lifestyle that he's resided himself to. But, you know, he's just doing a lot of great things. And he had a big hit called Attention off of the upcoming new album. The new song, How Long, has already attracted 93 million views on YouTube. The video has. So Charlie Puth is a lot more popular than he really gives himself credit for. And he's a lot more talented than perhaps he even realizes himself. Great guy. Had him on my show, Border Crossings. Pleasure to talk to. Very down to earth. Nice guy. Creative mind. a brilliant mind when it comes to music and rearranging songs. And he's the guy singing today's song of the day, How Long.
So he's got a great future ahead of him.
He's got a bright future ahead of him. I'm sure he's going to be a headliner. Right now he's opening for Shawn Mendes, as I mentioned. But when that tour ends, I'm sure he's going to be out promoting his own new album, Voice Notes, in 2018.
All right. Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
How long has this been going on? You've been creeping around on me while you're calling me.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dave Magnus. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As part of the continuing U.S.-Bangladesh partnership dialogue, Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Thomas Shannon recently met with Bangladeshi Foreign Secretary Shahidul Haq in Dhaka. They discussed further strengthening the U.S.-Bangladesh political, economic, and energy partnership and counterterrorism cooperation. They also discussed the North Korean nuclear threat and U.S. assistance for Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. During the meeting, Undersecretary Shannon thanked the government of Bangladesh for its generosity in responding to the refugee crisis in Burma's Rakhine State and expressed appreciation for its efforts to ensure assistance reaches the refugees in Bangladesh. More than 600,000 Rohingya have crossed into Bangladesh from Burma's Rakhine State since late August, amid brutal violence by the Burmese military and local vigilantes, acting in concert with the security forces in what the UN has called a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Simon Henshaw, acting U.S. Assistant Secretary for Population, Refugees, and Migration, recently visited refugees and internally displaced people in Burma and Bangladesh. Henshaw praised Bangladesh's government and its people for supporting the refugees and urged the government of Burma to establish conditions that will allow for the safe, voluntary, and dignified return of refugees to their own home and their own land. Henshaw said, "Responsibility for repatriation lies with the government of Burma. It is responsible for starting up the process and making sure that they are providing the safe and secure area for people to voluntarily return." The United States is deeply concerned over the well-being of those who have fled and has provided nearly $40 million in humanitarian aid for refugees, host communities, and persons internally displaced in response to the Rakhine State crisis since August 25th. This brings the total U.S. humanitarian assistance for displaced persons in Burma and refugees from Burma in the region to nearly $104 million in fiscal year 2017. The United States continues to call on Bangladeshi and Burmese officials to develop a framework for the safe and voluntary return of the Rohingya communities to Burma. The United States urges rapid and complete implementation of the Annan Commission's recommendations, including urgent provision of humanitarian and media access throughout Rakhine State and ensuring accountability for perpetrators of human rights violations with a view towards creating conditions for long-term peace and development in Rakhine State.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.